Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Let's talk. Talk.
John Brown. Justice for my father. In 1983, an off-duty prison officer was shot by the IRA in cold blood on a Dublin street. Over 40 years later, no one has been convicted of his murder. In this book, his son, Austin, outlines why justice must be done. I am joined live on the line by the author of the book, Justice for My Father, Austin Stack. Austin, good morning to you.
Good morning, Jez.
Whereabouts are you today, by the way, sir?
I'm in Portlaoise in the middle of Ireland.
A very nice part of the world indeed. Just explain a little bit about then for people who don't know who your father was.
Okay, so my dad was the chief prison officer in Portlaoise prison in 1983. So at the time, Portlaoise was Ireland's maximum security prison. It still is. And the chief class one is the head of security, basically. And at the time, Portlaoise prison would have been renowned as one of Europe's most secure prisons. And it held terrorist prisoners, IRA, INLA mostly, also some gangland prisoners. And at the time, obviously the height of the Irish Troubles, the IRA prisoners in particular would have seen themselves as prisoners of war. I suppose for your Spanish counterpart, it would be a little bit like ETA. And they felt that they had an obligation to escape. And my dad was obviously, as the chief prison officer, was the main person that was trying to stop them escaping. And so that's the kind of the background.
And one of the things you see, if you mention the Troubles in sort of the late 70s and the early 80s, when it was at its terrible height, people will automatically think prisons are basically, it's the maze and it's the H blocks and it's, you know, Bobby Sands and the Dirty Process and whatever else. And they will immediately try and think that it's like this military high security situation. But your dad had a different view, didn't he, on the prisoners, that they were human beings first and then prisoners second. It was a different way of perhaps looking at it.
Yeah, look, he very rarely talked about his work because of the security nature of it. But, you know, I do recall two particular instances when he did talk about work. And one was you know, he said to us that you have to remember you're dealing with human beings. And while he had absolutely no truck with what particularly the terrorist prisoners were in for, and he didn't like what they were in for, He also saw the human side to him and a human side to them. And I do recall one in particular incident where he was quite annoyed that a chaplain had come into the prison and given the wrong details of a death in the family to a prisoner, an IRA prisoner. And my dad had to go back and kind of undo the damage that had been done. And he kind of said to us, look, you have to remember you're dealing with human beings. It's, you know, and you can't just say, oh, let that go, you know. And, you know, he also, I remember the only other time he would have spoken about the prison was in relation to the murder of Senator Billy Fox. And, you know, in an Irish context, he was quite unique because we have two houses in the Irish Parliament. It's quite similar to the US that you have two houses. The British system is similar. You have the Lords and the Commons. In Ireland, you have the Senate and you have the Gardaí. And the Senate would be the upper house, and Senator Billy Fox was from Monaghan, but he was a Church of Ireland man, which would have been the less dominant religion in the 26 counties. And he was murdered by the IRA when he was on a visit to his fiancée. And my father always felt that that was a particularly heinous crime because, first of all, it was an attack on democracy, but it was also a sectarian attack. And he really felt that was a particularly, you know, evil act. And, you know, that it showed the human side of him. Because we were brought up in my family. You know, my dad was what you would call a pure Republican. He believed that everybody, no matter what your religion, creed, race, had an equal voice, and that democracy derived from that voice. And that's how he brought us up. He brought us up on, you know, my house was, when we were young, was filled with books, you know, about the French Revolution and the Wolf Tones and all of those, you know, pure Republicans. And, you know, that's what we learnt as kids. And that's how, but my dad lived that.
But not only that, I mean, he had a life outside of, because people are always sort of two-dimensional, I always find in these situations. You're black or you're white, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, if you are, you know, if you are in the prison surface, then you go home and you nothing happens outside. You know, you go to work, you go home, there's no life outside of it. But your dad was, I mean, your dad was passionately involved in boxing and also the sport that I can never get my head around, which is GAA.
Yeah, yeah. You see, my dad used that as a release, I suppose, and he was very much into Irish culture and Irish sport. So the GAA, the hurling, which is probably the one you're talking about with the sticks, and the Gaelic football. And the hurling was particularly a passion of his. And Portlaoise was, a middle-sized town at the time. It's now quite a big town. But hurling had kind of died a death. He was one of the people that kind of got involved and tried to bring hurling back. But he was also a sports administrator. So when in his younger days, while playing, he was also a referee. And he refereed a couple of fairly big games at the Gaelic football. And he was also involved then in getting the secretary of the Portlaoise Boxing Club. And he was an international boxing judge and referee. But for him, I suppose a lot of that was a release. It was his way of cutting himself off from what was going on in the prison. And, you know, he encouraged the prison officers. And a lot of the prison, he used to organise sports days and table quizzes and stuff for the prison officers as a way of getting them a release from what was going on. You know, you come out of the prison in the evening and you cut yourself off from that part of the world, but you also have another release. And he was very mindful of that with his colleagues, that himself and obviously his colleagues, that they needed that extra dimension to life to take their minds off the particularly, you know, because it was a very tense atmosphere working in Portlaoise at the time.
I mean, this sort of thing now is sort of standard and, you know, therapy, but he's kind of ahead of his time, isn't he? That's because people don't think about the prison officers, because they've got to leave these situations high tension. You don't know what's going on. And it's not all sort of, you know, shutting people in, but it's also, you know, you get the emotional bond, you get the stories. You know, some people are in prison because they are just things have gone horribly wrong for them, and you can't just switch off and go home and close the door and then be, you know, say hello to your lovely wife and your kids. So I suppose in a way he is ahead of his time in that way.
Yeah, very much so. And like I know when I joined the prison service myself in 1991, and at the time you weren't supposed to talk to prisoners. That was the rules, and you know, it was very much a them and us, whereas now you're encouraged to talk to prisoners and get to know what's going on in the prisoners' lives, so then you can preempt where they have struggles or preempt what might be trouble coming down the line and divert the prisoner into various ways of doing things that would prevent that. But my dad was a little bit ahead of his time in that respect, yeah, definitely. So, seeing the value of say, prisoners who may have come from particular backgrounds that wouldn't have made their religious confirmations and stuff like that, he would have organised for the chaplains to do that. But he went an extra distance in that he would have organised for a little party for them in the prison afterwards, you know. So that, little things like that.
It's interesting because, I mean, a lot of people who don't know how prison systems work, I'm talking about the UK, I presume it's pretty much the same, as you get those who go, oh, well, who have obviously never experienced what prison is like. Just, it's, you know, they should be suffering during their time, hard labour and lock away the key. And then there's a lot of people actually have to work on the cold faces that were going, well, yeah, if you don't just want to see them in another 7 months or another year and a half, you've got to try and point out at least and show them there's a slightly better way if it's, you know, for certain things, obviously.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, that's the type of man that he was. Now, I will say he was also, you know, extremely diligent at his job, and he was extremely security conscious. And you have to remember at the time that the IRA were trying to smuggle in guns, explosives. They had a particularly big escape where 19 guys got out about 5 or 6 years beforehand, and they had blown a hole in the wall of the prison. So you had all that going on, and my father was particularly good at the time. He had cultivated an informant within the IRA, and he also knew that the man that was directly above him, a deputy governor, was in league with the IRA and was helping them out. And it was at that point that he was changing a particular lock on a particular gate every month, so that whenever the IRA prisoners, he knew they were trying to plan an escape, and whenever they needed to go, they needed to get through this one particular gate, and he changed the lock every month, so they had no chance of being ahead of him. And every time they got a key to the gate, they found it was changed. The lock had been changed on it. And it showed that he was extremely diligent that way. And that's why the IRA wanted to get rid of him, because they knew they couldn't have, they were trying to effect an escape in Portlaoise, but also in the Maze at the same time, had to have a big, massive PR coup. And if kind of people may remember that the IRA had a massive escape out of the Maze prison at the back end of 1983, and so that's what the intention was, to have this massive PR coup.
And it's not only the IRA. I mean, we're also talking about the Irish National Liberation Army as well, the INLA, who were out there, basically, yeah? They were even further, you know, committed to what they saw as their cause.
Yeah, they were particularly, they weren't as organised as the IRA. They wouldn't have had the same resources. They were basically an offshoot of what would have been at the time the original official Sinn Féin. And they wouldn't have had the same resources. They wouldn't have had the same manpower. They wouldn't have had the same ability to organise things. While they were particularly more vicious and probably more sectarian than the IRA, but they were there. There was also a Dublin gangland, the start of the...
Yes, the Dubs, etc.
Were also in Portlaoise at the time.
So, yeah, I think we could use the word, an interesting mix, I think the word we can use in that situation.
But they would have all been kept separately.
Yeah.
So had the IRA and INLA prisoners were on what is known as the E Wing in the E Block in Portlaoise, and they would have had separate landings. And they had their own control structures within the prison.
It's 1983. You're 14 years old. A difficult time for anybody, and you're in a particular situation. I don't know how I'm going to phrase this, so bear with me, Austin, in this one. Were you, because I don't want to be dramatic about it, but were you kind of aware that there was the potential for something to go horribly wrong? In terms of what happened to your father? I mean, as a young man growing up, did you kind of realize that obviously you're living where you're living, the situation, did you think, well, you know, what my dad's doing is perhaps?
We wouldn't have really thought that there was the potential for something to go horribly wrong. I do know in the couple of months before the attack on my dad, he started locking his bedroom door at night time, and that was in direct, it was directly related to an attack that happened on a former chief officer. He was retired from Dublin, who had been attacked by a group of ex-prisoners in his bed at night, and my dad started locking his bedroom door after that. But he always just said to us, look, don't talk to anybody about what I do. Don't talk to your friends, if some of your friends, their parents might ask them to ask you. Now, there was very few IRA sympathisers around Portlaoise at the time. At the time, you would have to look at it in the round, in that when election time came, Sinn Féin would get maybe 1-2% of the poll at election time. So they weren't a force, and there wasn't that many sympathisers around. And I suppose you just had to be careful, is what we were told, not to talk about my dad's movements or what he did. It has transpired since that we do know of two occasions when he was followed going through the National Stadium, the Boxing Stadium in Dublin. But he kind of, both of those occasions, he wrote them off as people being the people that saw it. Like, he was driving to the stadium one night with another boxing coach, and the guy that was with him said, you know, that there's a motorbike following us for some considerable distance. And my dad just kind of going, look, don't be stupid, you know. And there was another occasion about 2 weeks before the shooting But my brother Oliver won the Leinster boxing title and in the stadium, and they were going back to have something to eat with a few of the coaches, and they were being followed by a motorbike. And the motorbike was so intent on watching what my dad was doing in the car that he came off the motorbike. And then a car came around the corner, picked the guy up, put him in the car and drove off and left the motorbike there. And one of the other coaches had saw it, what has happened. And he said to my dad, Brian, did you not see that? And he says, oh, yeah, yes. You know, strange things happen in Dublin. And that was the way he kind of put it down to. And he was not concerned about himself at all.
The thing is, he's attacked, he's shot. Outside, after a boxing match he's been to?
Yeah, so he was after the National Senior Finals. And there was a friend of my dad's, who my dad had kind of championed his cause. He was a heavyweight boxer. And this guy was from the same hometown as my father's mother, my grandmother. And that's where my dad took such an interest in him. And he won the heavyweight final. And my dad went back into the dressing room to congratulate him. And the rest of his friends, there was five of them, and the driver, Joe, being his son, Christy, who would have been my brother Kieran's class in school, they were all waiting in the car for my dad. And young Christy was the one that actually saw what happened. He saw it happen clear as day, you know. And he was walking across the road, and a guy came up behind him and shot him in the back of the head. And two doctors that were in the box and came running out. There were two lads from Belfast, two doctors, and obviously being from Belfast, they were well able to do field hospital techniques, and they cut this windpipe tracheotomy in his neck to get some air down, and they saved his life for the night. But he was brought to hospital, and he was in a coma for 6 months, and when he woke up then he was very badly brain damaged, and he was paralysed from the neck down.
And he succumbed to his injuries, didn't he? So a year and a half later, I think it was when he passed.
Yeah. He was in hospital. He was in a coma for 6 months, and they transferred him to the National Rehabilitation Hospital, which deals with paralysis cases. And when he woke up from the coma, they did what they could from out there, and he was there for, I suppose, nearly 12 months. And the last 6 months of his life, he was sent home because he was holding up a bed in the National Center, and they couldn't really do a whole lot more for him. And my mother had to go to the expense of, you know, doing an extension on the house, building a special bathroom, getting a tracking system on the roof, buying a particular type of bed. And, you know, these things were just, I suppose, expensive at the time. And it just became, you know, you'd get a new car. And she no sooner had all this stuff done, and my dad was home, and then he just passed away he just collapsed one morning, and then a week later he was brought straight to the hospital, and he passed away. But his organs had basically all given up.
Mm. You become a young man, you join the prison service. You said you went into the prison service. Yeah. Yourself. It would have been very easy to be bitter and you could understand, having gone through that trauma, and, you know, and become hardened in a way that perhaps your father wouldn't have wanted you to, and you start the background to this book. You start to try and look for the people who did it, but not for the reasons, if you like, of revenge. Is this sort of for understanding, or to bring, I mean, the Americans would call it closure. And just quickly, two other things, because for a lot of people, I mean, we've got generation, whatever they call them now, who don't know about, I mean, it's isn't crazy if you grew up the same time as, and we're the same age in the 80s, it was front and center during the 70s. Even on the mainland, obviously, we had Birmingham, we had, you know, the bombings, and we knew all about this. And there's also been a change in the narrative that, you know, that and again, using it carefully, romanticizing sort of as the IRA were, as they were in sort of 1916 or 19, whatever. And this is obviously got to sort of stick in your maw, as it were, Austin.
Yeah, there's a couple of things there. First of all, yeah, you know, it was very easy for me to be bitter, and I was very bitter as a, you know, 16, 18, up to the time I was about 20, I suppose, I did hold me even later, you know, because I wasn't sleeping at night. I had two sleep patterns, one where I would stay up until I'd be awake in the bed at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, wondering what happened to my dad, why it happened. And then the other sleep pattern would be I'd go to sleep and wake up at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning and not be able to get back to sleep. And I do remember I was writing when Mark McGuinness ran for President of Ireland in 2011. The one thing that particularly galled me at that, he was on a TV programme and he was being challenged by the presenter about his IRA past, and he was denying it. And the guy lifted up about 7 or 8 books from under the counter and said, well, this esteemed journalist says you were, this esteemed journalist said this. And he looked at him and he said, how do you sleep at night? And McGuinness stared down into the camera and goes, I sleep very well at night, thank you. And I'm sitting there watching this and I haven't slept for nearly 20 years at this stage. And if I could have pulled Martin McGuinness through the TV that evening, I would have done. Okay. And the following morning I went into work and I said, I have to address this. And I started to write an opinion piece that I was going to send to the Irish Independent. And I wrote it up and I knew you don't do anything in anger. And I left it in a folder on the computer. And I went back to it about 3 days later and I kind of made it less bitter. I tidied it up a bit and I sent it into the Irish Independent and the biggest selling newspaper in the country. And they published it without making any editorial changes to it. And I suppose at that point I saw that I had a voice and I saw, but it also showed me that, you know, while I was bitter, I thought I had tamed it down. But a friend of mine rang me and she said to me, oh my God, Austin, I've seen that article in the paper this morning. And she said, it's very bitter. And I just said to her, Mary, you should have seen the first draft. She started laughing, but she was coming from a very religious perspective. And she said to me, you need to learn how to forgive, Austin. And now at this stage of my life, I would have been someone that if the person that murdered my dad was being put on the gallows, I would have very easily have pulled the trapdoor. Okay. And I was full of that. And she kept saying to me, you know, I said, I'll leave all that old religious stuff out of it, Mary. She said, no, 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 I'm telling you, you need to think about this. And I was going home, driving home that evening, and it was playing on my mind all day what she had said. And I can still remember where I was on the road. And it was like I was struck by a bolt of light. And I was passing this soccer pitch, and suddenly the light went out of my head. And I said, if I could twist what she said and make it work for me. So what I came up with was, and I was driving, and I was literally only about 2 minutes from home. And in that 2 minutes, everything just kind of came in a circle to me. So if I can forgive them, not for them, but for me, okay? So what it is I'm taking this bitter monkey off my back and I'm handing it back to them. And I'm saying, you did this. This is yours. You're responsible for what happened. You take responsibility for this. And I'm saying to you, I forgive you. You go and deal with it now. And that's how, and I give talks on that. And, you know, I've given talks to groups of victims up in Northern Ireland. Now, some of them, it depends on where you are in dealing with what happened in your life. Some people may not be ready to hear that. Other people may be ready to hear that and go a step further. But for me, it has helped me. I've slept since. I've been able to get on with my life since. I can still write about what happened. I can still challenge the IRA and Sinn Féin to come clean about the past, to come clean about what they did. But I can do it from a place that I'm not bitter and it doesn't weigh me down.
Mm.
You know, so, yeah, I was bitter. Yes, I was in that space. But I've kind of come full circle on that. But for us, I suppose justice means that I did it to Gerry Adams when I went to meet him, that if the IRA gave us a full admission of responsibility, that we would be prepared to say, look, okay, let nobody be charged with this. And we're done. We've had our closure because you guys have now owned up to it and fessed up to it. For me, I would have liked to have met the person that did it and speak to them and challenge them. I mean, the one thing about doing, I'm big into restorative justice. And the one thing about restorative justice, some people think it's a kind of a fluffy way of doing things. But it's not. You can actually challenge the person. If I was in a room with that person, I could challenge them and robustly challenge them as to why they did what they did and pick holes in what they did. Like, when we meant to meet with Gerry Adams and the senior IRA commander up the mountains, that was an extraordinary meeting and how we did it and how I organized it and stuff. You know, we were put into the back of a blacked out van and brought up the side of the Cooley Mountains. And we were basically, Adams now says, we were brought into South Armagh, which was bandit country. The British Army didn't even go there. And we met a senior IRA commander. And basically, they initially said they didn't do it. The IRA, INLA, and Prisoner Revenge Group all issued statements saying they had not carried out the attack. But the IRA gave us an admission that day. They told us that an IRA commander had organised the attack and had got his team of IRA team to carry out the attack. They then said it wasn't sanctioned by the Army Council. So that was where they went about 70% of the way there. The reason that they did that was that I am aware through talking to people, I was talking to one man who was actually in the room the attack on my dad was organised in a house about 3 miles outside of Portlaoise, where I'm from. And there was at the time in 2013, two of the people that were in that room in 1983 organising the attack, two of them in 2013 were senior Sinn Féin politicians. So Sinn Féin could not admit full responsibility and say it was sanctioned because two of their leading politicians were in the room that day. And, you know, that information has come from another individual that was at that meeting in that house on that night that I spoke to. He's in the witness protection program, or he was, and I tracked him down and went to see him in London. And we had a meeting. We spent the whole day together, you know. So I've got information from various sources, you know, high level Gardaí, journalists, and it all is the same information. But that day, I was able to challenge Adams when we got I was saying to you about doing a restorative meeting and be able to challenge people robustly. When they told us it wasn't sanctioned by the Army Council, I was able to challenge Adams and say, yes, it was. It was sanctioned by the officer commanding at the Southern Brigade of the IRA. He was the one that gave the go-ahead. And, you know, to have that level of information that I had, but I wanted them to admit to it.
Austin, I'm going to run out of time and crash the news, which is the thing. I'm really sorry, because I could talk to you about this for probably until Thursday. If people want to find you and get the book, where's the best place to go, please?
So, okay, you can hit me up on Twitter, ADStack68, or on Facebook, Austin Stack. I'm on Facebook. Okay, so those are the two best places to get me.
And you can order the book via our own virtual bookstore. Listeners, go and...
If people in Europe want to get the book, okay, kennys.ie do free worldwide shipping.
Perfect. The book is called Justice for My Father. Austin, thank you so much for your time today.
Cheers. Thank you.